Between them, the Reach will be in good hands if it happens that I am needed elsewhere. The governance of the realm must come first, Lord Tywin often said, and I am pleased to bring your grace good tidings in that regard. My uncle Garth has agreed to serve as Master of Coin, as your Lord Father wished. He is making his way to Old Town to take ship. His sons will accompany him. Lord Tywin mentioned something about finding places for the two of them as well, perhaps in the City Watch. The Queen's smile had frozen so hard she feared her teeth might crack. Garth the Gross on the small council and his two bastards in the gold cloaks? Do the Tyrells think I will just serve the realm up to them on a gilded platter? The arrogance of it took her breath away. Garth has served me well as Lord Seneschal, as he served my father before me, Tyrell was going on. Littlefinger had a nose for gold, I grant you, but Garth...
My lord, Cersei broke in, I fear there has been some misunderstanding. I have asked Lord Giles Rossby to serve as our new Master of Coin, and he has done me the honor of accepting.
Mace gaped at her. Rossby? That coffer? But the matter was agreed, Your Grace. Garth is on his way to Old Town.
Best send a raven to Lord Hightower and ask him to make certain your uncle does not take ship. We would hate for Garth to brave an autumn sea for naught. She smiled pleasantly. A flush crept up Tyrell's thick neck.
This, your lord father assured me, he began to sputter.
Then his mother appeared and slid her arm through his own. It would seem that Lord Tywin did not share his plans with our regent. I can't imagine why. Still, their tears. No use hectoring her grace. She is quite right. You must write Lord Leighton before Garth boards a ship. You know the sea will sicken him and make his farting worse.
Lady Olenna gave Circe a toothless smile.
Your council chambers will smell sweeter with Lord Giles, though I dare say that coughing would drive me to distraction. We all adore dear old Uncle Garth, but the man is flatulent. That cannot be gainsaid. I do abhor foul smells.
Her wrinkled face wrinkled up even more.
I caught a whiff of something unpleasant in the Holy Sept, in truth. Mayhaps you smelled it, too.
No,
Circe said coldly.
A scent, you say. More like a stink.
Perhaps you miss your autumn roses. We have kept you here too long. The sooner she rid the court of Lady Olenna, the better. Lord Tyrell would doubtless dispatch a goodly number of knights to see his mother safely home, and the fewer Tyrell swords in the city, the more soundly the queen would sleep.
I do long for the fragrances of Highgarden, I confess it, said the old lady, but of course I cannot leave until I have seen my sweet Marjorie wed to your precious little Tommen.
I await that day eagerly as well,
Tyrell put in. Lord Tywin and I were on the point of setting a date, as it happens.
Perhaps you and I might take up that discussion, Your Grace.
Soon.
Soon we'll serve,
said Lady Olenna with a sniff. Now come along, Mace. Let her grace get on with her grief.
I will see you dead, old woman,
Circe promised herself as the Queen of Thorns tottered off between her towering guardsmen, a pair of seven-footers that it amused her to call left and right. We'll see how sweet a corpse you make. The old woman was twice as clever as her lord's son, that was plain. The queen rescued her son from Marjorie and her cousins and made for the doors. Outside, the rain had finally stopped. The autumn air smelled sweet and fresh. Tommen took his crown off.
Put that back on,
Circe commanded him.
It makes my neck hurt, the boy said,
but he did as he was bid.
Will I be married soon?
Marjorie says that as soon as we're wed, we can go to Highgarden.
You are not going to Highgarden, but you can ride back to the castle.
Circe beckoned to Sir Merin Trant. bring His Grace a mount, and ask Lord Giles if he would do me the honour of sharing my litter? Things were moving more quickly than she had anticipated. There was no time to be squandered. Tommen was happy at the prospect of a ride, and of course Lord Giles was honoured by her invitation, though when she asked him to be her master of coin, he began coughing so violently that she feared he might die right then and there. But the mother was merciful, and Giles eventually recovered sufficiently to accept, and even began coughing out the names of men he wanted to replace, customs officers and wool factors appointed by Littlefinger, even one of the keepers of the keys. "Name the cow what you will, so long as the milk flows, and should the question arise, you joined the council yesterday." A fit of coughing bent him over.
"Yesterday, to be sure."
Lord Giles coughed into a square of red silk, as if to hide the blood in his spittle. Circe pretended not to notice.
"When he dies, I will find someone else."
Perhaps she would recall Littlefinger. The Queen could not imagine that Peter Baelish would be allowed to remain Lord Protector of the Vale for very long, with Lyssa Arryn dead. The Vale lords were already stirring, if what Pycelle said was true. Once they take that wretched boy away from him, Lord Peter will come crawling back.
"Your Grace,"
Lord Giles coughed and dabbed his mouth.
"Might I,"
he coughed again,
"ask who?"
Another series of coughs racked him.
"Who will be the King's hand?"
"My uncle,"
she replied absently. It was a relief to see the gates of the Red Keep looming large before her. She gave Tommen over to the charge of his squires and retired gratefully to her own chambers to rest. No sooner had she eased off her shoes than Jocelyn entered timidly to say that Caiban was without and craved audience.
"Send him in,"
the Queen commanded.
"A ruler gets no rest."
Caiban was old, but his hair still had more ash than snow in it, and the laugh lines around his mouth made him look like some little girl's favourite grandfather.
A rather shabby grandfather, though.
The collar of his robe was frayed, and one sleeve had been torn and badly sewn.
"I must beg your Grace's pardon for my appearance," he said. "I have been down in the dungeons making inquiries into the imp's escape, as you commanded."
"And what have you discovered?"
"The night that Lord Varys and your brother disappeared, a third man also vanished."
"Yes, the jailer. What of him?"
"Rugen was the man's name, an under-jailer who had charge of the black cells. The chief under-jailer describes him as portly, unshaven, gruff of speech. He held his appointment of the old king, Aerys, and came and went as he pleased. The black cells have not oft been occupied in recent years. The other turnkeys were afraid of him, it seems, but none knew much about him. He had no friends, no kin, nor did he drink or frequent brothels. His sleeping cell was damp and dreary, and the straw he slept upon was mildewed. His chamber pot was overflowing."
"I know all this." Jamie had examined Rugen's cell, and Sir Adam's gold cloaks had examined it again.
"Aye, your Grace," said Caiban. "But did you know that under that stinking chamber pot was a loose stone which opened on a small hollow, the sort of place where a man might hide valuables that he did not wish to be discovered?"
"Valuables?" This was new. "Coin, you mean?" She had suspected all along that Tyrion had somehow bought this jailer.
"Beyond doubt, to be sure, the hole was empty when I found it. No doubt Rugen took his ill-gotten treasure with him when he fled. But as I crouched over the hole with my torch, I saw something glitter. So I scratched in the dirt until I dug it out."
Caiban opened his palm.
"A gold coin."
"Gold, yes. But the moment Circe took it, she could tell that it was wrong. Too small, she thought, too thin. The coin was old and worn. On one side was a king's face in profile, on the other side the imprint of a hand. "This is no dragon," she said.
"No,"
Qaiban agreed. "It dates from before the conquest, Your Grace. The king is Garth the 12th, and the hand is the sigil of House Gardner."
"Of High Garden."
Circe closed her hand around the coin.
"What treachery is this?"
Mace Tyrell had been one of Tyrion's judges, and had called loudly for his death. Was that some ploy? Could he have been plotting with the imp all the while, conspiring at father's death? With Tywin Lannister in his grave, Lord Tyrell was an obvious choice to be King's Hand, but even so. "You will not speak of this with anyone," she commanded. "Your Grace may trust in my discretion. Any man who rides with a sellsword company learns to hold his tongue, else he does not keep it long. In my company as well." The queen put the coin away. She would think about it later. "What of the other matter?"
"Sir Gregor."
Qaiban shrugged. "I have examined him as you commanded. The poison on the viper's spear was manticore venom from the east. I would stake my life on that. Pycelle says no. He told my lord father that manticore venom kills the instant it reaches the heart. And so it does. But this venom had been thickened somehow so as to draw out the mountain's dying."
"Thickened?
Thickened how? With some other substance?" "It may be as Your Grace suggests, though in most cases adulterating a poison only lessens its potency. It may be that the cause is less natural, let us say. A spell, I think." "Is this one as big a fool as Pycelle?" "So are you telling me that the mountain is dying of some black sorcery?" Qaiban ignored the mockery in her voice. "He is dying of the venom, but slowly and in exquisite agony. My efforts to ease his pain have proved as fruitless as Pycelle's. Sir Gregor is overly accustomed to the poppy, I fear. His squire tells me that he is plagued by blinding headaches and oft quaffs the milk of the poppy, as lesser men quaff ale. Be that as it may, his veins have turned black from head to heel. His water is clouded with pus, and the venom has eaten a hole in his side as large as my fist. It is a wonder that the man is still alive, if truth be told."
"His size," the queen suggested, frowning. "Gregor is a very large man, also a very stupid one. Too stupid to know when he should die, it seems."
She held out her cup, and Sennel filled it once again. "His screaming frightens Tommen. It has even been known to wake me of a night. I would say it is past time we summoned Illyn Payne."
"Your Grace," said Qaiban, "mayhaps I might move Sir Gregor to the dungeons. His screams will not disturb you there, and I will be able to tend to him more freely."
"Tend to him," she laughed.
"Let Sir Illyn tend to him."
"If that is Your Grace's wish," Qaiban said. "But this poison, it would be useful to know more about it, would it not? Send a knight to slay a knight, and an archer to kill an archer, the small folk often say, to combat the black arts." He did not finish the thought, but only smiled at her. "He is not Pycelle, that much is plain." The queen weighed him, wondering. "Why did the Citadel take your chain?"
"The Archmaesters are all craven at heart. The grey sheep, Marwyn calls them. I was as skilled a healer as Ibros, but aspired to surpass him. For hundreds of years the men of the Citadel have opened the bodies of the dead to study the nature of life. I wished to understand the nature of death, so I opened the bodies of the living. For that crime the grey sheep shamed me and forced me into exile. But I understand the nature of life and death better than any man in Old Town."
"Do you?" That intrigued her. "Very well. The mountain is yours. Do what you will with him, but confine your studies to the black cells. When he dies, bring me his head. My father promised it to Dorne. Prince Doran would no doubt prefer to kill Gregor himself, but we all must suffer disappointments in this life.
Very good, Your Grace.
Kyburn cleared his throat. I am not so well provided as Pycelle, however. I must needs equip myself with certain... I shall instruct Lord Giles to provide you with gold sufficient for your needs. Buy yourself some new robes as well. You look as though you've wandered up from Flea Bottom. She studied his eyes, wondering how far she dared trust this one. Need I say that it will go ill for you if any word of your labors should pass beyond these walls?
No, Your Grace.
Kyburn gave her a reassuring smile.
Your secrets are safe with me.
When he was gone, Circe poured herself a cup of strong wine and drank it by the window, watching the shadows lengthen across the yard and thinking about the coin.
Gold from the Reach. Why would an under-jailer in King's Landing have gold from the Reach unless he were paid to help bring about Father's death?
Try as she might, she could not seem to bring Lord Tywin's face to mind without seeing that silly little half-smile and remembering the foul smell coming off his corpse. She wondered whether Tyrion was somehow behind that as well. It is small and cruel. Like him. Could Tyrion have made Pycelle his cat's paw? He sent the old man to the black cells, and this Rugen had charge of those cells, she remembered. All the strings were tangled up together in ways she did not like. This High Septon is Tyrion's creature too, Circe recalled suddenly, and Father's poor body was in his care from dark till dawn. Her uncle arrived promptly at sunset, wearing a quilted doublet of charcoal-coloured wool, as sombre as his face. Like all the Lannisters, Sir Kevin was fair-skinned and blonde, though at 55 he had lost most of his hair. No one would ever call him comely. Thick of waist, round of shoulder, with a square, jutting chin that his close-cropped yellow beard did little to conceal, he reminded her of some old mastiff. But a faithful old mastiff was the very thing that she required. They ate a simple supper of beets and bread and bloody beef with a flagon of Dornish red to wash it all down. Sir Kevin said little and scarce touched his wine cup. He broods too much, she decided. He needs to be put to work to get beyond his grief. She said as much when the last of the food had been cleared away and the servants had departed. I know how much my father relied on you, Uncle. Now I must do the same.
You need a hand, he said, and Jamie has refused you.
He is blunt. Very well. Jamie, I felt so lost with father dead I scarce knew what I was saying. Jamie is gallant, but a bit of a fool, let us be frank. Tommen needs a more seasoned man, someone older.
Mace Tyrell is older.
Her nostrils flared.
Never.
Circe pushed a lock of hair off her brow.
The Tyrells overreach themselves. You would be a fool to make Mace Tyrell your hand, Sir Kevin admitted, but a bigger fool to make him your foe. I've heard what happened in the Hall of Lamps. Mace should have known better than to broach such matters in public, but even so, you were unwise to shame him in front of half the court.
Better that than suffer another Tyrell on the council. His reproach annoyed her. Rosby will make an adequate master of coin. You've seen that litter of his with its carvings and silk draperies. His horses are better dressed than most knights. A man that rich should have no problem finding gold. As for handship, who better to finish my father's work than the brother who shared all his counsels?
Every man needs someone he can trust. Tywin had me, and once your mother.
He loved her very much. Circe refused to think about the dead whore in his bed. I know they are together now, So I pray. Sir Kevin studied her face for a long moment before he replied.
You ask much of me, Circe.
No more than my father did.
I am tired.
Her uncle reached for his wine cup and took a swallow. I have a wife I have not seen in 2 years, a dead son to mourn, another son about to marry and assume a lordship. Castle Dari must be made strong again, its lands protected, its burned fields ploughed and planted anew. Lancel needs my help.
As does Tommen.
Circe had not expected Kevin to require coaxing. He never played coy with father.
The realm needs you.
The realm, aye, and House Lannister. He sipped his wine again. Very well. I will remain and serve his grace.
Very good,
she started to say, but Sir Kevin raised his voice and bulled right over her. So long as you name me regent as well as hand, and take yourself back to Casterly Rock. For half a heartbeat, Circe could only stare at him.
I am the regent,
she reminded him. You were. Tywin did not intend that you continue in that role. He told me of his plans to send you back to the Rock and find a new husband for you. Circe could feel her anger rising.
He spoke of such, yes, and I told him it was not my wish to wed again.
Her uncle was unmoved. If you are resolved against another marriage, I will not force it on you. As to the other, though, you are the Lady of Casterly Rock now. Your place is there.
How dare you,
she wanted to scream. Instead, she said,
I am also the Queen Regent. My place is with my son.
Your father thought not.
My father is dead.
To my grief and the woe of all the realm. Open your eyes and look about you, Circe. The kingdom is in ruins. Tywin might have been able to set matters aright, but I shall set matters aright.
Circe softened her tone. With your help,
uncle, if you will serve me as faithfully as you served my father.
You are not your father,
and Tywin always regarded Jaime as his rightful heir.
Jaime?
Jaime has taken vows. Jaime never thinks. He laughs at everything and everyone and says whatever comes into his head.
Jaime is a handsome fool.
And yet he was your first choice to be the king's hand. What does that make you, Circe?
I told you. I was sick with grief. I did not think.
No, Sir Kevin agreed, which is why you should return to Casterly Rock and leave the king with those who do.
The king is my son!
Circe rose to her feet.
Aye,
her uncle said, and from what I saw of Joffrey, you are as unfit a mother as you are a ruler. She threw the contents of her wine cup full in his face. Sir Kevin rose with a ponderous dignity.
Your grace.
Wine trickled down his cheeks and dripped from his close-cropped beard.
With your leave, might I withdraw?
By what right do you presume to give me terms? You are no more than one of my father's household knights.
I hold no lands, that is true, but I have certain incomes and chests of coins set aside.
My own father forgot none of his children when he died, and Tywin knew how to reward good service. I feed 200 knights and can double that number if need be. There are free riders who will follow my banner, and I have the gold to hire sellswords.
You would be wise not to take me lightly, your grace, and wiser still not to make of me a foe.
Are you threatening me?
I am counseling you.
If you will not yield the regency to me, name me your castellan for Casterly Rock, and make either Mathis Rowan or Randall Tarley the hand of the king.
Tyrell Bannermen, both of them.
The suggestion left her speechless.
Is he bought? She wondered.
Has he taken Tyrell gold to betray House Lannister?
Mathis Rowan is sensible, prudent, well-liked, her uncle went on, oblivious.
Randall Tarley is the finest soldier in the realm. A poor hand for peacetime, but with Tywin dead, there's no better man to finish this war. Lord Tyrell cannot take offense if you choose one of his own bannermen as hand. Both Tarley and Rowan are able men and loyal. Name either one, and you make him yours. You strengthen yourself and weaken Highgarden, yet Mace will likely thank you for it. He gave a shrug. That is my counsel. Take it or no. You may make Moon Boy your hand for all I care. My brother is dead, woman. I am going to take him home. Traitor, she thought. Turn cloak. She wondered how much Mace Tyrell had given him. You would abandon your king when he needs you most? She told him. You would abandon Tommen. Tommen has his mother. Sir Kevin's green eyes met her own unblinking. A last drop of wine trembled wet and red beneath his chin and finally fell. Aye, he added softly after a pause, and his father too, I think.
John. The world was grey darkness, smelling of pine and moss and cold. Pale mists rose from the black earth as the riders threaded their way through the scatter of stones and scraggly trees, down toward the welcoming fire strewn like jewels across the floor of the river valley below. There were more fires than Jon Snow could count, hundreds of fires, thousands. A second river of flickery lights along the banks of the icy white milk water. The fingers of his sword hand opened and closed. They descended the ridge without banners or trumpets, the quiet broken only by the distant murmur of the river, the clop of hooves, and the clacking of Rattleshirt's bone armor. Somewhere above, an eagle soared on great blue-gray wings, while below came men and dogs and horses and one white direwolf. A stone bounced down the slope, disturbed by a passing hoof, and John saw Ghost turn his head at the sudden sound. He had followed the riders at a distance all day, as was his custom, but when the moon rose over the soldier pines, he'd come bounding up, red eyes aglow. Rattleshirt's dogs greeted him with a chorus of snarls and growls and wild barking as ever, but the direwolf paid them no mind. 6 days ago, the largest hound had attacked him from behind as the wildlings camped for the night, but Ghost had turned and lunged, sending the dog fleeing with a bloody haunch. The rest of the pack maintained a healthy distance after that. Jon Snow's garron whickered softly, but a touch and a soft word soon quieted the animal. Would that his own fears could be calmed so easily. He was all in black, the black of the night's watch. But the enemy rode before and behind. Wildlings, and I am with them. Ygritte wore the cloak of Corrin Halfhand. Lennel had his hauberk, the big spare wife, Ragwill, his gloves. One of the bowmen, his boots. Corrin's helm had been worn by the short, homely man called Longspear Rick, but it fit poorly on his narrow head, so he'd given that to Ygritte as well. And Rattleshirt had Corrin's bones in his bag, along with a bloody head of Ebon, who set out with John to scout the Skirling Pass. Dead. All dead but me. And I am dead to the world. Ygritte rode just behind him. In front was Longspear Rick. The Lord of Bones had made the two of them his guards.
If the crow flies, I'll boil your bones as well, he warned them, when they had set out, smiling through the crooked teeth of the giant skull he wore for a helm.
Ygritte hooted at him.
You want to guard him. If you want us to do it, leave us be, and we'll do it.
These are free folk indeed, John saw. Rattleshirt might lead them, but none of them were shy in talking back to him. The wildling leader fixed him with an unfriendly stare.
Might be you fool these others, Crow, but don't think you'll be fooling Mance. He'll take one look at you and know your force, and when he does, I'll make a cloak of your wolf there and open your soft boy's belly and sew a weasel up inside.
John's sword hand opened and closed, flexing the burned fingers beneath the glove. But Longspear Rick only laughed. And where would you find a weasel in the snow? That first night, after a long day of horse, they made camp in a shallow stone bowl atop a nameless mountain, huddling close to the fire while the snow began to fall. John watched the flakes melt as they drifted over the flames. Despite his layers of wool and fur and leather, he felt cold to the bone. Ygritte sat beside him after she'd eaten, her hood pulled up and her hands tucked into her sleeves for warmth.
When Mance hears how you did for Halfhand, he'll take you quick enough, she told him.
Take me for what? The girl laughed scornfully.
For one of us. Do you think you're the first crow ever flew down off the wall? In your hearts, you all want to fly free.
And when I'm free, he said slowly, will I be free to go?
Sure you will.
She had a warm smile, despite her crooked teeth.
And we'll be free to kill you. It's dangerous being free, but most come to like the taste of it.
She put her gloved hand on his leg, just above the knee.
You'll see.
I will, thought John, I will see, and hear, and learn. And when I have, I will carry the word back to the wall. The wildlings had taken him for an oath-breaker, but in his heart he was still a man of the night's watch, doing the last duty that Corrin Halfhand had laid on him, before I killed him. At the bottom of the slope, they came upon a little stream flowing down from the foothills to join the milk water. It looked all stones and glass, though they could hear the sound of water running beneath the frozen surface. Rattleshirt led them across, shattering the thin crust of ice. Mance Raider's outriders closed in as they emerged. John took their measure with a glance, 8 riders, men and women both, clad in fur and boiled leather, with here and there a helm or bit of mail. They were armed with spears and fire-hardened lances, all but their leader, a fleshy blond man with watery eyes who bore a great curved scythe of sharpened steel. The Weeper, he knew at once. The Black Brothers told tales of this one. Like Rattleshirt and Harmer Dugshead, an elfin crow killer, he was a known raider.
The Lord of Bones, the Weeper said when he saw them.
He eyed John and his wolf.
Who's this, then?
A crow come over, said Rattleshirt, who preferred to be called the Lord of Bones, for the clattering armour he wore. He was afraid I'd take his bones as well as Halfhand's. He shook his sack of trophies at the other wildlings.
"He slew Corrin Halfhand," said Longspear Rick. "Him and that wolf is."
"And did for O'Rell too," said Rattleshirt. "The lad's a warg, or close enough," put in Ragwill, the big spear wife. "His wolf took a piece of Halfhand's leg."
The Weeper's red, rheumy eyes gave John another look.
"Aye. Well, he has a wolfish cast to him, now as I look close. Bring him to Mance. Might be he'll keep him."
He wheeled his horse around and galloped off, his riders hard behind him. The wind was blowing wet and heavy as they crossed the valley of the Milkwater and rode single file through the river camp. Ghost kept close to John, but the scent of him went before them like a herald, and soon there were wildling dogs all around them, growling and barking. Lennel screamed at them to be quiet, but they paid him no heed.
"They don't care much for that beast of yours," Longspear Rick said to John.
"They're dogs, and he's a wolf," said John. "They know he's not their kind. No more than I am yours." But he had his duty to be mindful of, the task Corrin Halfhand had laid upon him as they shared that final fire, to play the part of Turncloak and find whatever it was that the wildlings had been seeking in the bleak, cold wilderness of the Frostfangs. Some power, Corrin had named it to the old bear, but he had died before learning what it was, or whether Mance Rayder had found it with his digging. There were cook fires all along the river, amongst wains and carts and sleds. Many of the wildlings had thrown up tents of hide and skin and felted wool. Others sheltered behind rocks in crude lean-tos, or slept beneath their wagons. At one fire, John saw a man hardening the points of long wooden spears and tossing them in a pile. Elsewhere, two bearded youths in boiled leather were sparring with staffs, leaping at each other over the flames, grunting each time one landed a blow. A dozen women sat nearby in a circle, fletching arrows. Arrows for my brothers, John thought. Arrows for my father's folk, for the people of Winterfell and Deepwood Mott and the Last Hearth. Arrows for the north. But not all he saw was warlike. He saw women dancing as well, and heard a baby crying, and a little boy ran in front of his garron, all bundled up in fur and breathless from play. Sheep and goats wandered freely, while oxen plodded along the river bank in search of grass. The smell of roast mutton drifted up from one cook fire, and at another he saw a boar turning on a wooden spit. In an open space surrounded by tall green soldier pines, Rattleshirt dismounted. "We'll make camp here," he told Lennel and Ragwell and the others. "Feed the horses, then the dogs, then yourself. Ygritte, Longspear, bring the crow so Mance can have his look. We'll gut him after." They walked the rest of the way, past more cook fires and more tents, with Ghost following at their heels. John had never seen so many wildlings. He wondered if anyone ever had. "The camp goes on forever," he reflected. "But it's more 100 camps than one, and each one more vulnerable than the last. Stretched out over long leagues, the wildlings had no defences to speak of, no pits, no sharpened stakes, only small groups of outriders patrolling their perimeters. Each group, or clan, or village, had simply stopped where they wanted, as soon as they saw others stopping or found a likely spot. The free folk. If his brothers were to catch them in such disarray, many of them would pay for that freedom with their life's blood. They had numbers, but the Night's Watch had discipline, and in battle, discipline beats numbers 9 times of every 10, his father had once told him. There was no doubting which tent was the king's. It was thrice the size of the next largest he'd seen, and he could hear music drifting from within. Like many of the lesser tents, it was made of sewn hides with fur still on. But Mance Rayder's hides were the shaggy white pelts of snow bears. The peaked roof was crowned with a huge set of antlers from one of the giant elks that had once roamed freely throughout the Seven Kingdoms in the times of the First Men. Here, at least, they found defenders, two guards at the flap of the tent, leaning on tall spears with round leather shields strapped to their arms. When they caught sight of Ghost, one of them lowered his spear point and said, "That beast stays here." "Ghost, stay," John commanded. The dire wolf sat. "Longspear, watch the beast." Rattleshirt yanked open the tent and gestured John and Ygritte inside. The tent was hot and smoky. Baskets of burning peat stood in all four corners, filling the air with a dim, reddish light. More skins carpeted the ground. John felt utterly alone as he stood there in his blacks, awaiting the pleasure of the turncloak who called himself King Beyond the Wall. When his eyes had adjusted to the smoky red gloom, he saw 6 people, none of whom paid him any mind. A dark young man and a pretty blonde woman were sharing a horn of mead. A pregnant woman stood over a brazier cooking a brace of hens, while a grey-haired man in a tattered cloak of black and red sat cross-legged on a pillow, playing a lute and singing,
Oh, the Dornish man's wife was as fair as the sun, and her kisses were warmer than spring. But the Dornish man's blade was made of black steel, and its kiss was a terrible thing.
John knew the song, though it was strange to hear it here, in a shaggy hide tent beyond the wall, 10,000 leagues from the red mountains and warm winds of dawn. Rattleshirt took off his yellowed helm as he waited for the song to end. Beneath his bone and leather armour he was a small man, and the face under the giant's skull was ordinary, with a knobby chin, thin moustache, and sallow, pinched cheeks. His eyes were close set, one eyebrow creeping all the way across his forehead, dark hair thinning back from a sharp widow's peak.
The Dornish man's wife would sing as she bathed in a voice that was sweet as a peach, but the Dornish man's blade had a song of its own and a bite sharp and cold as a leech.
Beside the brazier, a short but immensely broad man sat on a stool, eating a hen off a skewer. Hot grease was running down his chin and into his snow-white beard, but he smiled happily all the same. Thick gold bands, graven with runes, bound his massive arms, and he wore a heavy shirt of black ringmail that could only have come from a dead ranger. A few feet away, a taller, leaner man, in a leather shirt sewn with bronze scales, stood frowning over a map, a two-handed greatsword slung across his back in a leather sheath. He was straight as a spear, all long, wiry muscle, clean-shaven, bald, with a strong, straight nose and deep-set grey eyes. He might even have been comely if he'd had ears, but he had lost both along the way, whether to frostbite or some enemy's knife John could not tell. Their lack made the man's head seem narrow and pointed. Both the white-bearded man and the bald one were warriors. That was plain to John at a glance. These two are more dangerous than Rattleshirt by far. He wondered which was Mance Rayder.
As he lay on the ground, with the darkness around, and the taste of his blood on his tongue, his brothers knelt by him and prayed him a prayer, and he smiled, and he laughed, and he sung. Brothers, oh brothers, my days here are done. The Dornish man's taken my life. But what does it matter? For all men must die, and I've tasted the Dornish man's wife.
As the last strains of the Dornish man's wife faded, the bald, earless man glanced up from his map and scowled ferociously at Rattleshirt and Egret, with John between them.
"What's this?" he said. "A crow?" "The black bastard what gutted Aurel," said Rattleshirt, "and a bloody wag as well. You were to kill them all."
"This one's come over," explained Egret. "He slew Corin Halfhand with his own hand."
"This boy?"
The earless one was angered by the news.
"The Halfhand should have been mine. Do you have a name, crow?"
"John Snow, your grace." He wondered whether he was expected to bend the knee as well.
"Your grace?" The earless man looked at the big white-bearded one. "You see? He takes me for a king."
The bearded man laughed so hard he sprayed bits of chicken everywhere. He rubbed the grease from his mouth with the back of a huge hand.
"A blind boy, must be. Whoever heard of a king without ears? Why, his crown would fall straight down to his neck. Ha ha!"
He grinned at John, wiping his fingers clean on his breeches.
"Close your beak, crow. Spin yourself around. Might be you'd find who you're looking for."
John turned. The singer rose to his feet.
"I'm Mance Rayder," he said, as he put aside the lute, "and you are Ned Stark's bastard. The Snow of Winterfell."
Stunned, John stood speechless for a moment before he recovered enough to say,
How could you know?" "That's a tale for later," said Mance Rayder. "How did you like the song, lad?"
"Well enough. I'd heard it before."
But what does it matter, for all men must die? The king beyond the wall said lightly. And I've tasted the Dornish man's wife. Tell me, does my Lord of Bone speak truly? Did you slay my old friend the Half-Hand?
I did, though it was his doing more than mine.
Ah, the Shadow Tower will never again seem as fearsome, the king said, with sadness in his voice. Corrin was my enemy, but also my brother once. So, shall I thank you for killing him, Jon Snow, or curse you? Hmm? He gave Jon a mocking smile.
The king beyond the wall looked nothing like a king, nor even much a wilding. He was of middling height, slender, sharp-faced, with shrewd brown eyes and long brown hair that had gone mostly to grey. There was no crown on his head, no gold rings on his arms, no jewels at his throat, not even a gleam of silver. He wore wool and leather, and his only garment of note was his ragged black wool cloak, its long tears patched with faded red silk. "You ought to thank me for killing your enemy," John said finally, "and curse me for killing your friend."
"Har!" boomed the white-bearded man. "Well answered."
"Agreed."
Mance Rayder beckoned John closer.
"If you would join us, you'd best know us. The man you took for me is Styr, Magnar of Thenn. Magnar means lord in the old tongue."
The earless man stared at John coldly as Mance turned to the white-bearded one.
"Our ferocious chicken-eater here is my loyal Tormund. The woman..."
Tormund rose to his feet.
"Old, ye gave Styr his style. Give me mine."
Mance Rayder laughed.
"Cast your wish. Jon Snow, before you stands Tormund Giant's Bane, tall talker, horn blower, and breaker of ice. And here also Tormund Thunderfist, husband to bears, the mead king of Ready Hall, speaker to gods, and father of hosts."
"That sounds more like me," said Tormund. "Well met, Jon Snow. I am fond of wargs, as it happens, though not a Stark's."
"The good woman at the brazier," Mance Rayder went on, "is Darla."
The pregnant woman smiled shyly.
"Treat her like you would any queen. She is carrying my child."
He turned to the last two.
"This beauty is her sister Val. Young Jarl beside her is her latest pet."
"I'm no man's pet," said Jarl, dark and fierce.
"And Val's no man,"
white-bearded Tormund snorted.
"You ought to have noticed that by now, lad."
"So there you have us, Jon Snow," said Mance Rayder. "The king beyond the wall and his court, such as it is. And now some words from you, I think. Where did you come from?"
"Winterfell," he said, "by way of Castle Black."
"And what brings you up the Milkwater so far from the fires of home?"
He did not wait for John to answer, but looked at once to Rattleshirt.
"How many were they?"
"Five. Three's dead, and the boy's here. T'other went up a mountainside where no horse could follow."
Raider's eyes met John's again.
"Was it only the five of you? Or are more of your brothers skulking about?"
"We were four and the Half-Hand. Corrin was worth 20 common men." The king beyond the wall smiled at that.
"Some thought so. Still, a boy from Castle Black with rangers from the Shadow Tower. How did that come to be?"
John had his lie already. "The Lord Commander sent me to the Half-Hand for seasoning, so he took me on his ranging." Styr the Magnar frowned at that.
"Ranging, you call it? Why would crows come ranging up the Skirlin Pass?"
"The villages were deserted," John said truthfully. "It was as if all the free folk had vanished."
"Vanished, eh?" said Mance Rayder. "And not just the free folk. Who told you where we were, Jon Snow?"
Tormund snorted.
"It were Craster, or I'm a blushing maid. I told you, Mance, that creature needs to be shorter by a head.
The king gave the older man an irritated look.
Torment, some day, try thinking before you speak. I know it was Craster. I asked John to see if he would tell it true.
Ah, Torment spat. Well, I stepped in that.
He grinned at John.
See, lad, that's why he's king and I'm not. I can outdrink, outfight, and outsing him, and my members thrice the size of his. But Mance has cunning. He was raised a crow, you know, and the crow's a tricksy bird.
I would speak with the lad alone, my lord of bones,
Mance Raider said to Rattleshirt.
Leave us, all of you.
What, me as well?
Said Torment.
No, you especially, said Mance.
I ain't in no hall where I'm not welcome.
Torment got to his feet.
Me and the ends are leaving.
He snatched another chicken off the brazier, shoved it into a pocket sewn into the lining of his cloak, said, ha! And left, licking his fingers. The others followed him out, all but the woman Darla.
Sit if you like,
Raider said when they were gone.
Are you hungry? Tormin left us two birds at least.
I would be pleased to eat, Your Grace, and thank you.
Your Grace,
the king smiled.
That's not a style one often hears from the lips of free folk. I'm Mance to most, the Mance to some. Will you take a horn of mead?
Gladly, said John. The king poured himself, as Darla cut the well-crisped hens apart and brought them each a half. John peeled off his gloves and ate with his fingers, sucking every morsel of meat off the bones.
Tormund spoke truly, said Mance Raider, as he ripped apart a loaf of bread. The black crow is a tricksy bird, that's so. But I was a crow when you were no bigger than the babe in Darla's belly, John Snow. So take care not to play tricksy with me.
As you say, you're Mance. The king laughed.
You're Mance. Why not? I promised you a tale before of how I knew you. Have you puzzled it out yet?
John shook his head. Did Rattleshirt send word ahead?
By wing? We have no trained ravens, no. I knew your face. I've seen it before. Twice.
It made no sense at first, but as John turned it over in his mind, dawn broke. When you were a brother of the Watch?
Very good, yes. That was the first time. You were just a boy, and I was all in black, one of a dozen riding escort to old Lord Commander Corgill when he came down to see your father at Winterfell. I was walking the wall around the yard when I came on you and your brother Rob. It had snowed the night before, and the two of you had built a great mountain above the gate and were waiting for someone likely to pass underneath.
I remember, said John with a startled laugh. A young black brother on the wall walk.
Yes.
You swore not to tell.
And kept my vow. That one, at least.
We dumped the snow on Fat Tom. He was father's slowest guardsman. Tom had chased them around the yard afterward until all three were red as autumn apples. But you said you saw me twice. When was the other time?
When King Robert came to Winterfell to make your father hand,
the king beyond the wall said lightly. John's eyes widened in disbelief.
That can't be so. It was. When your father learned the king was coming, he sent word to his brother Benjen on the wall so he might come down for the feast. There is more commerce between the Black Brothers and the Free Folk than you know, and soon enough word came to my ears as well. It was too choice a chance to resist. Your uncle did not know me by sight, so I had no fear from that quarter. And I did not think your father was like to remember a young crow he'd met briefly years before. I wanted to see this Robert with me own eyes, king to king, and get the measure of your uncle Benjen as well. He was first ranger by then, and the bane of all my people. So I saddled my fleetest horse and rode.
But, John objected, the wall.
The wall can stop an army, but not a man alone. I took a lute and a bag of silver, scaled the ice near Long Barrow, walked a few leagues south of the New Gift, and bought a horse. All in all, I made much better time than Robert, who was travelling with a ponderous great wheelhouse to keep his queen in comfort. A day south of Winterfell, I came up on him and fell in with his company. Free riders and hedge knights are always attaching themselves to royal processions in hopes of finding service with the king, and my lute gained me easy acceptance.
He laughed.
I know every bawdy song that's ever been made north or south of the wall. So, there you are. The night your father feasted Robert, I sat in the back of his hall on a bench with the other free riders, listening to Orland of Old Town play the high harp and sing of dead kings beneath the sea. I betook of your lord father's meat and mead, and had a look at Kingslayer and Imp, and made passing note of Lord Eddard's children and the wolf pups that ran at their heels.
"Bale the Bard," said John, remembering the tale that Ygritte had told him in the Frostfangs, the night he'd almost killed her.
Would that I were. I will not deny that Bale's exploit inspired mine own, but I did not steal either of your sisters that I recall. Bale wrote his own songs and lived them. I only sing the songs that better men have made. More mead.
No, said John. If you had been discovered, taken,
your father would have had my head off.
The king gave a shrug.
Though once I had eaten at his board, I was protected by guest right. The laws of hospitality are as old as the first men, and sacred as a heart tree.
He gestured at the board between them, the broken bread and chicken bones.
Here you are the guest, and safe from harm at my hands, this night at least. So tell me truly, John Snow, are you a craven who turned your cloak from fear, or is there another reason that brings you to my tent?
Guest right or no, John Snow knew he walked on rotten ice here. One false step, and he might plunge through into water cold enough to stop his heart. Weigh every word before you speak it, he told himself. He took a long draught of mead to buy time for his answer. When he set the horn aside, he said, Tell me why you turned your cloak. I'll tell you why I turned mine. Mance Rayder smiled, as John had hoped he would. The king was plainly a man who liked the sound of his own voice.
You will have heard stories of my desertion, I have no doubt.
Some say it was for a crown, some say for a woman. Others, that you had the wildling blood.
The wildling blood is the blood of the first men, the same blood that flows in the veins of the Starks. As to a crown, do you see one?
I see a woman. He glanced at Darla. Mance took her by the hand and pulled her close.
My lady is blameless. I met her on my return from your father's castle. The half-hand was carved of old oak, but I am made of flesh, and I have a great fondness for the charms of women, which makes me no different from three-quarters of the watch. There are men still wearing black who have had 10 times as many women as this poor king. You must guess again, John Snow.
John considered for a moment. The half-hand said you had a passion for wildling music.
I did. I do. That's closer to the mark, yes, but not a hit.
Mance Rayder rose, unfastened the clasp that held his cloak, and swept it over the bench.
It was for this.
A cloak?
The black wool cloak of a sworn brother of the Night's Watch, said the king beyond the wall. One day, on arranging, we brought down a fine big elk. We were skinning it when the smell of blood drew a shadow cat out of its lair. I drove it off, but not before it shredded my cloak to ribbons. Do you see? Here. Here. And here. He chuckled. It shredded my arm and back as well, and I bled worse than the elk. My brothers feared I